Okay, topic is affluenza. And it's not my term, by the way. I didn't make this up. It's a term that actually was made by Jesse O'Neill, who wrote a book about it called about affluenza. And if you look, I actually have some printouts here about this. And we'll refer back to that. Oh, I guess I can wear this. That might be easier. Okay. And the definition of affluenza is, okay, well, anyone, regardless of their net worth, who believes that they must be rich, that more is always better, is a self-condemned prisoner of the golden ghetto. Or simply defined, affluenza is a dysfunctional relationship with money, wealth, or the pursuit of it. And apropos, there's a cartoon here that shows a guy saying, you know, in front of his mansion, I could cry when I think the years I wasted accumulating money, only to learn that my cheerful disposition is genetic. But affluenza is a relationship, or if you want to look at it, a sick relationship with money and possessions. It has nothing to do with how much you have. You can be wealthy and have a healthy, wholesome relationship and attitude towards what you own and your possessions, or you can be poor and have a pathological or sick relationship, if you will, towards possessions and items. Fortunately, today we live in a time when most of us are very well off, and most of us are doing quite well. When you talk to people who were even in Europe before the war, whatever, they'll say that, you know, the major benefactor at that time today would be nothing. We're seeing affluence and opulence that's really literally unprecedented. And on the other hand, though, we have demands on us, especially in the Orthodox community, that are also unprecedented. Some of them are the normal natural demands. You know, everybody knows what the Orthodox Jewish birth control is, right? Yeshiva tuitions, right? Orthodox Jewish birth control is yeshiva tuitions. We have tremendous pressures, but even social pressures in terms of what neighborhoods we live in, camps we send our kids to, etc. And the reality is that you have to have, just like you have to have a relationship with your children that's defined by certain parameters, and just like you have a relationship with your spouse that's defined by certain parameters, and you have a relationship with your parents that's defined by certain parameters, you have a relationship with what you own, and you have a relationship, if you will, with your money. And there's an approach and an attitude towards money that is a wholesome one. There's a rabbi that I'm friendly with who has a very funny line. I'll say it in the way he says it, and I'll translate. He says, you know, the Talmud says, Ezu Hashira Samech B'chelko. He says, that's Midaraisa, Midarabanim and Daf Gelt. In other words, who's rich, he's happy with his lot. That's only according to the Torah. The rabbis say you need money. But the truth of the matter is, yeah, on the one hand, we can be very idealistic, and we can say money is unimportant, etc. And I'm going to read to you, show you how unimportant money is. But on the other hand, we need it. So what should be our relation with money? But just again to show how times have changed and what bearing money has on our happiness or unhappiness, I'd like to direct you to the handout. And if you don't have to follow, I'm going to read it. But it just will give you a sense of what's happened in the last 50 years and whether it's really making us happier. Number one, today's typical three-car garage is about the size of the average home in the 1950s. Americans carry $1 trillion in personal debt, approximately $4,000 for every man, woman, and child, not including real estate or mortgage. On average, Americans save only 4% of their income, in contrast to Japanese, who save an average of 16%. In 2002, over 1.5 million Americans declared bankruptcy, almost five times as many as did in 1986. Americans carry more than $700 billion in revolving debt, like bank credit cards and retail cards. The most recent Federal Reserve study showed that 43% of U.S. families spend more than they earned. On the average, Americans spend $1.22 for each dollar they earned. So we are overextending ourselves. Since 1950, Americans alone have used more resources than everyone who ever lived before them. Each American individual uses up to 20 tons of basic raw material annually. Americans throw away 7 million cars a year, 2 million plastic bottles an hour, and enough aluminum cans annually to make 6,000 DC-10 airplanes. 26% of children under 2 have a TV in their room. The average American child sees 40,000 commercials a year. The United States, with 4.5% of the world's population, buys 45% of global toy products. The average American child gets 70 new toys a year. 86% of Americans who voluntarily cut back their consumption feel happier as a result. Only 9% said they were less happy. A survey reveals that Forbes 100 wealthiest Americans are only slightly happier than the average American. The clearest evidence of this, quote, greening of America comes from the annual UCLA and American Council on Education survey of nearly 250,000 students entering college. Those agreeing that a, quote, very important, close quote, reason for their going to college was to, quote, make more money rose from 1 in 2 in 1971 to 3 in 4 in 1998. The proportion who consider it, quote, very important or essential that they become, quote, very well off financially rose from 39% in 1970 to 74% in 1998. Among 19 listed objectives, this was number one, outranking, quote, developing a meaningful philosophy of life, becoming an authority in any field, helping others in difficulties, and raising a family. So we are preoccupied with wealth. Now, even though we consume twice as much as we did then, this is the most important one probably, the number of people who describe themselves as, quote, very happy has not increased at all since 1957. Quote, it is hard to avoid the startling conclusion our becoming much better off over the last four decades has not been accompanied by one iota of increased subjective well-being. And that's a fancy word for saying happiness. So we're much wealthier, we're consuming much more, and yet we're no happier. In fact, a psychologist about 5 years ago woke up one day and said, you know, we've been spending years and years studying why people are depressed. Why don't we study why people are happy? So they did this huge international study on what is the source or what are causes for happiness. They called it subjective well-being because happy doesn't sound scientific enough, but it's happiness. And they came up, and I will do a little interactive, okay? They came up with the three F's that are the sources of happiness. Anyone want to take a bet? Guess what those three F's are? Family's one, right? Good.
Finance
is not at all.
No.
Friends is two. They got two. The third nobody ever gets. Well, you read it already, right? No? Very good. Faith. Friends, family, faith. If you have good friends, you have a close-knit family, and you belong to a synagogue or lahavdil, a church or mosque, you are a happy person. And then as we used to say in yeshiva, what's a tzara shava b'neim? What do all three have in common? What do all three of these have in common? Friends, family, faith. What do they all have in common? What's the connect? What's the leitmotif?
Love.
It's a personal.
Interpersonal love, connectedness. If you feel connected, you feel connected to a family, you feel connected to friends, you feel connected to a community, you're a happy person. Money has no connection whatsoever with happiness. And in fact, how you think about yourself. And I've heard this from people, again, those were studies. I'll tell you what I've heard in my office. I know some people I've worked with who said they grew up poor, but they didn't feel poor. There was just, first of all, sometimes if you grew up in, I mean, I remember one person telling me that he grew up in the Lower East Side with a, you know, in a three-floor walk-up with outside plumbing, but he didn't know he was poor because he thought everybody lived that way until he ventured out and saw that other people lived differently. But besides that, it's your attitude. And I remember, you know, sometimes commenting, especially when I used to work in a school in a very opulent neighborhood, and there were some kids I used to describe them as poor children with a lot of money because they constantly felt deprived. They constantly felt like they didn't have anything, and they had a ton of money. So, okay, can we wait till the end? Again, that's like my Ritalin is really wearing off now. It's like, okay. So there's a very, very much how you feel in terms of being entitled or feeling rich or poor, or what your relationship with money does not necessarily have any bearing on how much money you have. You can have a limited amount of resources and feel rich, and you can have a lot of money and you can feel poor. So how do we instill in our children, and for ourselves for that matter, a healthy attitude towards money? And that's what we're going to be talking about now. Number one, very important point. We have to teach our children, and for ourselves, for that matter, ourselves, the difference between needing and wanting. There are certain things you need. You need a roof over your head. You need a meal. You need clothing. You need an education. There's some things you want. And children, again, and by the way, we're up against some formidable odds. Because I want to tell you something. I don't mean to insult my friend and colleague, Johnny Krug, but brilliant psychologists did not spend Thanksgiving schlepping from New York to Chicago to lecture on parenting. Brilliant psychologists are on Madison Avenue in New York thinking of very incredible and genius commercials to convince our children that they need things which they need, like a hole in the head. And that's, so we're up against some fairly, please let me talk, fairly formidable odds. And we have to instill in our children, yes, there's certain things you need. You need your books for school. You need pencils. You don't need a shirt with a little alligator on it or a little schmanz written on it. You know, another shirt without that thing written on it, you know, is just as good. That's not needing. That's wanting. There's nothing wrong with wanting. It's not Oliver Twist. You can want, but what you want is not what you need. The other thing in terms of money, we have to look and perceive money as a means to an end, not an end in and of itself. People for whom the pursuit of wealth is the end are never satisfied. There's never enough. And our rabbi said it very succinctly, Oiv kesed lo yisba kesed. Whoever loves money will never be satisfied with money. But money is important. Money is important so we can provide an education. Money is important so that we can dress well. Money is important that we can give charity. Money is important so that we can give a good education. It is not an end in and of itself. It's a means. And by the way, it connects to some of the things we spoke about in the other, for those who were there, in the other group as well. Because then when you realize that, you give more graciously. Instead of whining and complaining, for that matter, about the tuitions, you should be grateful that you have the money to pay for it. Because look how your kids turn out from yeshiva in contrast to the kids who turn out from public school. I'm not going to say which ones are better. But, you know, it's for a purpose. Another very important point and something we have to keep in mind, and it doesn't matter how much money you have. And I want to share with you an experience I had. I'm obviously going to present it in ambiguous terms, but an experience that was an enlightening experience to me that happened just about a year or two ago. I'm involved with a program that is very generously endowed by an extremely wealthy benefactor who, from the reports from Forbes magazine and Fortune, has money that I can't even fathom. I don't even know how many zeros are involved in this because it's so removed from me. But someone who is really extremely wealthy and has endowed this program very generously. And I was at a meeting regarding this program because I work in this program. And the professional staff involved wanted to introduce a new program, a new aspect of the program, which would cost $30,000, $40,000, whatever. And the benefactor said, that's fine, I have no problem, but then you can't do as much in this end of the program because you've got a budget. And I'm looking at this benefactor, and I'm saying, I just read in Forbes magazine what you're worth, you know? So throw us another $30,000, $40,000. You know, what's the big deal? But you know something? That was a very important lesson. Even for someone like this person, there's a budget. It's not boundless, no matter what. It's not boundless, and we have to keep that in mind. No matter what, it's no matter how well you're doing, whatever, it's not boundless. There are always limits, and we have to impart that to our children. It's extremely important, even if you can say yes, that every once in a while you say no to them, just so they learn. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Otherwise, they're going to expect it always to be boundless, and it's not. So, and if a person like that can say that there's a limit, we have to know there always are limits. And that's what. And that sometimes we have to let our children practice not having. It's very important that sometimes they want something and don't get it. Because that's going to be true in life. There'll be things you're going to want and you're not going to get. So it's not that we insulate them. Let them see that there are certain things, or let them see that they have choices. That when Hanukkah comes, if they want the PSB, then they can't have the SBB or whatever it is. You know, I can't keep track of all these new games that are coming out. But, you know, that there's some things they're not going to have. Now, another thing. Let me share with you another very interesting study. Very interesting study. You have to, as we used to say in Yeshiva, halt kop. You know, you have to pay attention to this. But it's a very interesting study. This one goes back, and I said, psychologists now are studying happiness. They're very intrigued by what makes people happy. So listen to this study. They set up a situation where the subjects in the study had to do some sort of task. Like I don't remember what it was exactly. Some sort of like math or something like that. A task that was challenging, and they got a grade on it. And in the room with them was a confederate. In other words, it was somebody from the study. He didn't know that. He thought it was just another person doing this task. But really, the person was from the study. And no matter how well the subject did in the study, they always manipulated it that the confederate always did a little better. So if the subject got a 95, the confederate got 100. If the subject got a 60, then the confederate got a 70. And here's what they found. Now pay attention. They found, and before they did, they measured people's happiness. They found that happy people who did poorly on the task left more satisfied than unhappy people who did well, but the guy next to them did better. In other words, happy people don't compare. Unhappy people compare. No matter how well they're doing, they're always looking next door to see how the other one is doing. So that happiness or contentment in terms of money means being content with what you have, not looking over your shoulder what the other one has. Now, to tell a story, it's a great story. Tell a story about the Stipler. Stipler was a great rabbi who lived in the 50s in Israel. And one guy once came to him and said, you know, Rabbi, I have this store, and I'm making 25,000, whatever liras at that time, I guess, whatever, let's say dollars, maybe 1,000 a year. But the guy across the street is making 40,000. How come? He said, don't worry, it'll get better. Comes back a few months later, he said, okay, I'm making 50. The guy across the street is making 75. He said, don't worry, it'll get better. Comes back a few months later, he said, okay, I'm making 60. The guy across the street is making 150,000. Why is he making so much more than I am? He said, very simply, he said, he's running one business, you're running two businesses. You're running yours and his, you know? You're not paying attention to yours. In other words, you have to be happy, you have to work on, or you help your children be happy with what they have, not look over their shoulder and worry about what the other person has. That, by the way, doesn't mean that there isn't such a thing as healthy competitiveness. It doesn't mean that you can look at somebody else who's more successful and not resent it and not bemoan your fate that he's more successful, but say, gee, I'd like to be that successful. Let me think what he's doing that I could do too. That's okay. It doesn't have to even be about money. It can be about anything. That's like in sports. That's a healthy competitiveness where at the end of the game you shake hands and you feel good about the competitive spirit. But if it's resentment and if it's you're feeling sorry for yourself that the other person is doing better off, that leads to misery and that leads to a sick relationship with money. Okay, as we talk about in the other room, and I'll say it very quickly, with your children, when you give them something, give whatever you give, give graciously. What you don't give, it's an absolute no. Don't say, all right, maybe, okay, maybe I won't eat tomorrow and I can buy you that. You know, that's not giving. Or for that matter, don't say no. Oh, please, no. But everybody else has a no. But the Jones have it. Okay. You know, then you're teaching them to pressure you and arm twist you into giving. You decide what you're going to give. You're going to decide what they should have or shouldn't have and stick to your guns. But what you give, give with a smile on your face. Don't go on vacation. Don't plan a family trip. And every other thing they want to have in the trip, say they can't have. Yeah, going on a family vacation, enjoy the vacation. If you can't afford the vacation, don't go. But don't give half yeses and half noes. Also, a very important point, and that's part of developing a healthy attitude towards money and possessions, is gratitude. Not only to worry, as I said, what you don't have or what you want to have, but to be grateful and appreciative for what you do have. And that you can do that in very simple ways. You can do that. You can do that by just saying, saying thank you, or every once in a while, just spontaneously at the Shabbos table, saying, isn't this wonderful that we have such a beautiful table? Isn't it wonderful that we can afford such fine food? Things that we don't just take anything for granted. Again, tell a story, and it's a very beautiful story, and I want to read something from this book. The Chafetz Chaim, as I mentioned, was one of the great luminaries of our time. The Chafetz Chaim lived through World War I and died right before World War II. But after World War I, many of the Jewish communities in Europe were decimated, were destroyed. So Hayes, which was a very famous charity here in America, used to send regular financial stipends to some of those destroyed communities. So the community of Radin, where the Chafetz Chaim lived, was also decimated during World War I and received regular stipends from Hayes, and they depended on that. They were able to subside with that money. Came the crash in 29, and they couldn't afford him, and they send a letter. At this point, the Chafetz Chaim, maybe Rabbi can help me, it must have been in his 90s already or 80s, the letter that they sent to Radin, that they can't pay it anymore. They can't afford the stipends, are going to stop. They tried to hide it from the Chafetz Chaim, but they couldn't anymore because it affected the function of the yeshiva. So finally, they broke the news to him, and he quickly said, get me a pen, paper, I got to write a letter. And everybody assumed he's going to write a letter begging them to continue the payments. And instead, he wrote a letter thanking them for all the years that they sent the payments to him. That's an attitude, that's a healthy attitude towards money, and that's an attitude towards gratitude. Another very important point, savings. Teach our children to save. You can see from these statistics, we don't have a concept of saving. Now, you can overdo savings, too. You find, in fact, many from the generation who lived through the Depression were like almost excessive in terms of savings. And you have to strike a balance. You have to strike a balance between investing, but you have to also teach that there is such a thing as savings, and it's a very easy way to do it. One of the things I've suggested sometimes to parents is you say to them, you know, here's your allowance, or here are your bar mitzvah gifts. For every dollar you save, I'm going to put 50 cents in the saving account too. Or I'm going to put 25, whatever you want, whatever you can. But to encourage the concept of savings. Or for that matter, sometimes, you know, we all have these behavior mod charts, etc. One of the things we do sometimes is we reward kids with, like, fake money. We make, like, play money. And to encourage them to save it up for something special. Because you're not only then rewarding the positive behavior, you're teaching them this art of savings. And by the way, let me speak briefly also about allowance. A very important question I get asked a lot. I think allowances are wonderful. How much do you give? Again, you have to... allowance is not just giving a kid money. Otherwise, you just can dispense it. Allowance is to teach a kid budgeting. And you should try... I mean, again, you have to calculate what's going on in their lives, but to try to give them enough that they have to make decisions. Not so little that they, you know, that just to get by, they have to send away. If, let's say, every kid buys their lunch, you give them just enough for their lunch money, you're not teaching them anything. If you give them so much that they can have everything they want, you're not teaching them anything either. But if you give them enough that they have to make decisions, that they can say, you know what, I can buy ice cream today, or I can put it aside and buy some baseball cards. It can be silly things like that, but now you're teaching them what we all have to do. We all have to make decisions. Am I going to buy something? Am I going to save? Am I going to purchase? Learn that art, and that's the point of allowance, not just to give out money. Shabbos table conversations, okay? And I'm as guilty as this. Please not. I want you to think I'm preaching. I'm as guilty as this as anyone else. But if you're sitting at the Shabbos table and all you're talking about is the stock market and money, etc., you know what kind of message you're giving the children? You know the famous line, the only thing two Jews can agree upon? I don't know. It's what the third should give for charity. You know, it's everybody's busy talking about what everybody, you know, everybody, this one owns this and this one is that and this one, you know, et cetera. Now, again, it's part of life. And sometimes, again, maybe it's not Shabbos table isn't the appropriate time, but even so say, and we never eat together any other time, but let's say Thanksgiving table, you know. Maybe something will come up about the stock market, about investments. And that can come up, but that shouldn't be the major preoccupation or topic, because then look what you're conveying and look what you're teaching the children. And by the way, the other point is, you know, the what I call the delusions of unanimity, otherwise known as the everybody else's parents gets it for them syndrome, okay? You don't want to buy this thing or the other thing, right? But everybody else's parents do. You know why everybody else's parents do? Because their kid are telling them that you do. You know, you have to understand that children, and this I'm telling you this as a fact because I once worked in a school, children spend their recess plotting how to undermine us. They're together all day, and they're plotting. We don't talk to each other. We don't talk to other parents. Extremely important for all matters that you have contact with the parents of the other children in your school and classroom. Because you'll be surprised about how many things you guys all agree about. I'll tell you a situation I had. This goes back quite a few years already. I was in California, and I was talking about, at that time, I was talking about entertainment. And I blasted what was very popular at the time, that so-called professional wrestling, which was a grotesque display of unsportsmanlike conduct and violence. It's horrible stuff. And I blasted it. And this was a modern school. It was the Yavne Academy. And afterwards, a parent came to me and said, I'm so glad you talked. My kid watches it all the time, and I hate it, but all the other children watch it. And another parent came and said, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned it. I mean, my kids watch it. Before I know it, I had 10 parents together, and we agreed as a group, we're going to ban that show. It's very powerful. So talk to the other, and the same thing has to do with possessions. If every other kid has Lacoste and Abercrombie and everything like that, yeah, you don't want your kid to be different. And some parents are really overextending themselves that their kids should have everything the other parents do, and the other parents are doing the same thing. And if you can talk together and you can agree that, no, they can wear a sneaker that says life goes into height. It doesn't have to have some sort of fancy thing on it. Then you're sparing yourself, and you're also teaching your kids the right kind of values. Working for money. We mentioned this also in the other group as well. It's a very good lesson. Very good lesson. You appreciate what you have more. And there's nothing wrong, even with young children, to pay them for chores in the house, to say, you know, you want to make somebody go, you know, cut the bushes, the garden already cut them, let them cut them again. Give them some chores. Give them the sense of the appreciation of what it feels like, not just to be handed something, but to work for it. Okay. Oh, I wanted to read. Oh, maybe we'll get to that later. Maybe that's a nice thing to. Okay. Also, and again, I'm sorry. You know, I'm jumping around, but a very important lesson I said before about wanting and needing. They have to also teach the children the difference between spending and wasting, and that's a very important point. You know, you can waste a nickel, and that's bad. You can spend $500, and that's good. That's what's important with money, is not how much, it's not the quantity, but what you do with it. So buying a big piece of candy that you don't end up eating is a bad thing. Spending thousands of dollars on your yeshiva tuition is good because you're getting something for it. And that's, again, an important message. And by the way, can also become given, again, I'm not here to preach any kind of ideology, but even in terms of environmental things, even in terms of not throwing out, you know, the cans and recycling and all that, to teach people, to teach them the difference between waste and the value of certain things, instead of, as we said, to throw out so many aluminum cans that you can build 6,000 DC tents. Don't get bent out of shape over things. Okay? Yes, you have to have respect for items, but not, it shouldn't be so excessive. If the kids sit on the couch with their dirty pants, kids do that. And you shouldn't have white satin couches in your house if you have little kids. It's just you shouldn't have it. And if a kid sees you get enraged because you dirty the couch and you're kind of casual about the fact that they, you know, that they're mean to their friend, look what you're telling them. I have a colleague, she's actually much older now, she's not well in fact, but she was a psychiatrist of a unit where I was a psychologist. We became friends, and I even came over to her house sometimes, not a Jewish woman, not at all religious, and she and her husband had a thing that if something broke, you know, a vase broke and it crashed or whatever, or the camera got wet and doesn't work, they'd look at each other and say, it's only a thing, and go on. What a wonderful message. It's only a thing. Again, you have to have respect for things. You don't want the kids purposely destroying things. And you may have to teach them that you have to show some consideration and care for items. But kids are kids, and if it becomes the most egregious sin, again, you're promoting a certain materialism that is not a wholesome attitude. I remember a number of years ago, I was at a meeting with psychologists, and I have a practice in a town called the Five Towns. If you know, it was in New York, it's a fairly opulent area. And everybody was going around the room introducing themselves, where they're from and what their specialty is. And I guess that just, you know, makes me feel like, well, sarcastic, whatever. And it came my turn, I said, I'm Noam Blumenthal, I have a practice in the Five Towns, and I specialize in shopping disorders. I said that in joking, but again, if your major interest, if your major preoccupation, if you are most enthusiastic and excited about shopping, again, I understand shopping for certain genders is a very exciting experience. But, and there's nothing wrong with, I guess, to some extent, but if it becomes a disproportionate preoccupation, it's a message to your children. If it becomes more important than a sheer, more important than other, than quality time with the kids, so spending time going out and playing with the children, you're giving your kids a very powerful message. Another thing that comes up very often that's very much related to this is the issue of honesty. It'll be amazed sometimes what we convey to our children, but if you're sitting at the Shabbos table talking about how you out-swindled somebody for a buck, you're giving the kids, and the kids hear this. I got to tell you one story. I mean, it's classic. I was supervising a psychologist who worked for a special ed program, and she had a problem with one of the kids who was going into the principal's office and stealing, like, pens and paper clips and things like that. So she called the father, and she told him, and he said, I don't know why she has to do that. I bring that stuff all home from the office all the time. What do you have to figure out now? Where has she learned this? Kids pick up on everything. And again, we have to be very careful about what we say, what we talk about, cash deals, whatever you want to call it. And there's another message, and then, okay, we'll have some time. And that's, I think, a very important message. Maybe I'll read what I want to read you earlier, but I'll read it now. And that is a very important point, which is that wealth and money is not forever. It's cyclical. They're fat years, they're lean years, just like Joseph and his dreams. And it isn't, and I think we have to keep that in our mind, that we're very fortunate that we live in opulent times. It doesn't necessarily mean it'll always be that way. And you're not necessarily deprived or hurt if somehow or another it didn't work out, if it has somehow changed. Tell you two stories. My parents have a friend, again, I obviously remain nameless, who probably is in the New York metropolitan area, if not the one of the wealthiest Orthodox Jews. He, in his industry, he is like number one. Extremely wealthy man. Lovely man. Very fine man. And I remember, going back a long time, we had a surprise 59th birthday party for my father, because we figured nobody's going to think 59th birthday. And it's almost 30 years ago now. And at the time, so, you know, he was invited, and I was a young kid, and I was acting as a, you know, I was giving out drinks and things like that. And you know the problem with pouring soda, right? The fuzz fizzes up and you got to wait till it goes down. So I'm pouring everybody a drink and I'm waiting for the fizz to go down, pour them a little bit more. So this man, this multi-millionaire walks over to me and says to me, Norm, let me show you a trick I learned when I was a waiter. You know how powerful that was for me? He was once a waiter. There's another story, and I guess it's close to home here in Chicago, even though, I found this, okay. I found it, it took place in Cleveland. Many of you know who Irving Stone is. Irving Stone, right? Yeah. The Stone Chumash, extremely wealthy man. Multi. Now, this is a story, by the way, I'm not telling you anything private. It was told in public. I heard it in a public forum, so it's a known story. Some of you may know that Telstone, which is a community outside of Jerusalem, was a community that he bought. He purchased it, and he gave it over to the Telza Yeshiva. And originally, the Telza Yeshiva was going to relocate to there, and Rav Gifter, unfortunately, got sick, and they weren't able to do that. But when he handed it over to the Telza Yeshiva, he did it completely legally, lawyers and everything like that, and he handed over them, free and clear, this huge amount of property, a whole community. He had one condition. That was the only condition written into the contract. And the condition was that if any of his descendants, his children, his grandchildren, great-grandchildren, ever want to go to the yeshiva and can't afford the tuition, that they'll get tuition assistance. That's a lesson. That's someone who does not have affluenza. So let me read. This is a wonderful book, by the way. I would recommend it even in general. It's a book called Expecting Adam. Wait a second. Do I have the right spot? No. I'll tell you in a second. Okay, yeah, right. Here we go. It's a little long, but it's worth it. I think it's also a lesson in affluenza. It's written by Martha Beck. It's about this couple that were a Harvard couple, very into the Harvard scene, who were expecting a child, and the child was diagnosed with Down syndrome, and she decided to have the baby and not abort it, and how the professors at Harvard harassed her like crazy for not aborting the baby, and that led to a total disillusionment with these professors. But she had two other children, and she had this child, Adam. I'll read you this, and then we'll have some give and take. Every December, my friend Annette, who in other respects is a very nice person, spends an inordinate amount of time and money obtaining the most obnoxious toy gun on the market for Adam's Christmas present. I don't give my children guns as toys, but as Adam's honorary auntie, Annette feels that it is her right and responsibility to indulge the kid's most violent, macho, and antisocial tendencies. Adam loves her very much. Annette's first criterion when purchasing the Christmas gun is wattage. She looks for a product that makes enough noise to disrupt the breeding process for every bird living within a mile radius of our house. Flashing lights rank a close second. Annette prefers guns that flash several colors, all bright enough to stun the average person's retina, so that for a couple of minutes after Adam fires the gun at you, you walk blindly into walls and pillars and closed glass doors. Adam, again, is this kid with Down syndrome. It's also very important to have an innovative design with various exotic flanges meant to suggest deadliness of the interplanetary proportions. It goes without saying that guns of this magnitude require dozens of large batteries. Annette never forgets this. She always buys an ample supply of them, wrapping them in a separate package which she tapes to the actual gun. I'm telling you, the woman has absolutely no mercy. The first Christmas after Annette and I got to know each other, my children arose at a predictably ungodly hour and descended on their gifts like locusts on alfalfa fields. Along with most other American parents, John and I had spent a good part of the previous month tracking down the items our children had requested in their letters to Santa. Katie had asked for a set of bird calls she'd seen on F.A.O. Schwartz's catalog. 5-year-old Lizzie wanted one of those dolls they advertise in Saturday morning cartoons, the ones that have repulsively cute names and are engineered to mimic the least pleasant behaviors of real human beings, babies. I think that year Lizzie's doll had an anxiety-related bedwetting disorder and something like that. Adam wanted a whole brigade of toys with names like Cretan slime monsters. In the proud tradition of delayed gratification John inherited from a long line of Becks, the children opened their presents one by one. Katie went first. The F.A.O. Schwartz bird call set had turned out to cost several hundred dollars, so John and I purchased what we thought was a reasonable facsimile. It didn't cover quite as broad an ornithological spectrum as the pricier set, but it could produce a great duck sound and a good owl and several very convincing songbirds. When she saw it, Katie's face fell. It's an awful thing to see your kid's face fall on Christmas morning. "Don't you like it?" I asked anxiously. No, it's okay. I like it," Katie smiled with a stalwart smile, but her lower lip trembled ever so lightly. I began to feel that perhaps we should have taken out a second mortgage to pay for the F.A.O. Schwartz bird call set. Lizzie went next. She tore the gift wrapping off her bedwetting doll, and then she, too, developed a troubled look around her eyes. "What's the matter?" I asked. "Well," said Lizzie with her high voice and precocious vocabulary, "it's not exactly what I asked for." John, who had fought his way through about 17 toy stores looking for that particular doll, burst out, "I thought you wanted a tiny weeny Princess Wee Wee." "I did," said Lizard, "but I wanted the one with the pink jewels. This one only has purple jewels." Within a minute, both girls had reconciled themselves to their gifts, like their pioneer ancestors, many of whom died crossing the Great Plains on foot in the dead of winter, dragging their possessions behind them in hand carts. My daughters were able to steel themselves to the brutal realities of an imperfect world. This was good because I had been on the verge of sending them both to military school. Now it was Adam's turn. He fished around under the Christmas tree until he found a package with his name on it. It was from Annette. He tore off the paper off, holding his breath, and found batteries, an 8-pack of Double D's still encased in plastic. "Oh, honey," I said, "that's not the real present. The real present is..." But Adam didn't hear me. He was staring at those batteries as if they were so magnificent he couldn't take them in. His mouth fell open in astonished ecstasy as he held the batteries to the light. "Oh, wow," he said. "Oh, wow, Mom, look, batteries." It actually sounded like, "Mom, ook agabies." But the message was clear. Before we could divert his attention to any other gift, Adam leaped to his feet and began running around the house, locating every appliance, tool, and toy that ran on batteries. The whole time he babbled excitedly about all the things he could do with this fabulous, fabulous gift. As we watched, it began to occur to all of us, quote-unquote, normal people in the family, that batteries really were a pretty darn good Christmas present. They didn't look like much on the face of it, but think what they could do. Put them in place and inanimate objects suddenly come to life, moving, talking, singing, lighting up the room. Something about Adam always managed to see straight past the outward ordinariness of a thing to any magic it may hold inside. We wouldn't have even bothered to let him open the gun, except we were afraid Annette would buy him a neutron bomb for his birthday if we didn't. That's the solution to affluenza. Okay. Yeah, ask questions, please, by all means. I've never done a study. I don't know, but if you say so, I'll take your word for it. I think, frankly, all children feel entitled today. And if you want to see where this entitlement comes from, watch children's shows and look at the commercials. All the commercials are, you deserve this, you should get this, don't listen to your parents. Watch the commercials. Watch the commercials. Okay, can I give some other people a chance? Okay, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
From Hamlet, you know, where he tells them either a lender nor a
borrower. A borrower, right.
That's where that comes from.
Okay, right, absolutely.
The saying, rich gifts wax poor when given with a mean hand.
Yeah, go ahead.
How many parents have had their children say to them, for example, the question is, I was wondering how many people here have had the experience of their own children saying to them that there are people that are making more money than they are, but they basically feel that they need time off to be able to spend time with their family or just to do that rather than having to be the top.
Do you know the research on kids and families that eat dinner together? Have you come across that? It was in the media and everything. Research shows that families who eat dinner together on a regular basis have practically a zero instance of substance abuse. The reading scores of children whose families eat dinner together every night are higher than those children who don't.
Families that pray together stay together.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, as long as the women are on the other side of the pizza. Right. That's true. Right. Oh, I'm in trouble. I'll need security to get out of here, right? Yeah.
Freud found that people with imagined wrongs that they had committed sometime in the past that were not punished for, they had the most disturbances.
Yeah. Okay. People have imagined wrongs. Who have imagined wrongs are most disturbed. Yeah. That's unfortunately promoted sometimes by that type of therapy. Anybody else? Okay, great. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Thanks.